You're listening to KSCO, Santa Cruz, Salinas, Monterey, and San Jose, and 104 FM. This is From the Bookshelf. I'm Gary Shapiro. Thanks for joining me.
My guest this week is Daphne Geismar. She's an educator, book designer, and the author of Invisible Years, a family's collected account of separation and survival during the Holocaust in the Netherlands. It's a collection of memories and pictures and letters that seamlessly create a narrative of the Holocaust. It's a true time machine. Daphne Geismar, welcome to From the Bookshelf.
Thank you so much for having me.
So is this a memoir of your own family's history?
It is. It's two generations of my family, my parents, grandparents, aunts, and uncles.
And how did you put it all together? It must have been a daunting task to do.
It was. It could have taken on so many different forms, and it was actually quite some time until I even realized what I had. Eventually, I realized that I had this huge family archive of letters, diaries, interviews, documents, photographs from these two generations. My parents' generation were primarily adolescents, and then my grandparents were their parents at the time in their 40s. And I discovered this archive in 2006. And my grandparents wrote in Dutch and German, so that had to be translated. And then information continued to be found. And once I was able to read it all, I realized that the different family members were really telling the same story from different perspectives. And so that's when I did a test to see if I could weave their narratives together into one sequential story.
So you knew that your family were Holocaust survivors, but did you discover all kinds of things that were brand new to you when you were putting this together?
Yes. It's remarkable how little I did know. My parents did start speaking about their experiences about 50 years later. So I grew up knowing they were Holocaust survivors, but not knowing any of the details. And then once I was a young adult, they were speaking in schools and community centers, and I had a sense of the outlines of their stories. But after visiting a church in Rotterdam where my grandparents had been hidden in 2006, my mother and aunt started telling us more about the stories. And when I came back to the United States, and I asked her what she had, she opened this drawer that we now call the Holocaust drawer. And so one of the remarkable things in there that I knew nothing about was the discovery of my paternal grandfather, Erwin Geismar. There was a memoir in the drawer written by him. It was in German, and it was 49 pages. And he had been murdered in Auschwitz, so he's the only one of the eight Dutch narrators that didn't survive, or that had been in the Netherlands that didn't survive. And so with this memoir, I, for the very first time, learned about his circumstances. He, in great detail, he documented the German occupation and the first couple of years of the war. And I heard his voice for the first time. My father almost never talked about him. So that was one of many remarkable discoveries along this journey.
So it's not only a time machine for me, the reader, but it was a time machine for you too.
Very much so, yes. It was like I got to know my grandparents in particular for the first time. And their situation is just so different from my parents, because my parents were children and their education was cut off. And so after surviving, they went to Israel and then the United States and started with nothing. Whereas my grandparents were really well-read and cultured and well-educated, and in addition to these documents telling the stories of their experiences in the Holocaust, they also wrote a lot about their influences in philosophy and theosophy and religion. And I wasn't brought up religious. By the time my parents survived, they were done with religion. So yes, it was very much a time machine in that I felt like I was meeting my grandparents while working on this.
But you personally had no Jewish education? You didn't go to temple or anything like that?
None at all. Once my parents came here, they didn't speak any of the languages that they spoke before, and they didn't practice their religion. We celebrated Passover it was much more about the meal than about anything else. And we celebrated Hanukkah really as the Dutch celebrate the holiday time. So no, I never went to temple growing up.
And what about now? Has this changed your attitude towards your religion, having done this project?
So, it has. Prior to doing this project, I became interested in Buddhism. I went to a Buddhist temple for 7 years and read a lot of Buddhist texts. And now, having read my grandparents' writing, and I have a bibliography from my maternal grandfather that he constructed after he wrote the 70-page letter to his three daughters after the war to try to make sense of the world after the Holocaust. I've been reading some of the books that he read, and now that my work on the book is finished, I've been thinking if I found the right temple, it would be interesting to check it out.
Yes, that's interesting. So, I mean, because in a way it connects you to them in some way, right?
It does. And there in my maternal grandfather, Chaim in particular, he was really interested in all religions, and he wrote about the connections between Judaism and Christianity and Buddhism in particular. And he wrote about religion from a very spiritual and historical perspective. And that's of interest to me. So maybe he gave me that little window in.
Well, are there any living people who are in this book? Are there any still alive?
So only one of the narrators is still alive, my Aunt Judith. She lives in Israel. And she was actually the first person to clue me in on what all of the Dutch documents were about. So, you know, there were many that weren't appropriate for the book. So she would read through them and kind of give me a summary of what they were about. And if we thought they were possible material for the book, she might do a loose translation. And then anything that was going to be in the book was given to a professional Dutch to English translator. So working on those documents with her, despite the ocean between us, and talking about those documents and then talking about her experience in particular, brought us really close in a way that we never were, simply because we lived in two different countries and, you know, didn't see much of each other in our lives. But I wish everyone else was still here to see the book. I think they'd be really happy to know that these terrible but important experiences are going to be there for those to read if they want to.
Mm-hmm. Well, Daphne Geismar, you're the author of Invisible Years, A Family's Collected Account of Separation and Survival During the Holocaust in the Netherlands, but a lot of other people were contributors to the book. And not just the cast of characters who are telling us the story, but a lot of people who who helped you out. Who else was involved?
Right. And I know I am technically the author. I don't think of myself really as the author. I created it and I edited it and put it together, but the entire narrative is in the voices of these nine family members. And then in addition, I worked with two remarkable editors. Jenny Maggi was my developmental editor. So after I had put together a draft of the manuscript, I worked with Jenny for about 2 years. She had been living in New Haven where I live, but she was living in Switzerland by the time we started working together. So we were we were having our meetings virtually, and she further helped me shape the text. For example, initially I had all eight narrators' voices interwoven together, and she made the suggestion that that was really confusing for the reader who doesn't know who these people are. So we completely changed the structure so that each of the three nuclear families has a section within each chapter, so you don't have as many voices happening at the same time. It really does read like a play with these multiple voices. But that needed clarification. Jenny also, when I was first reading my family members' documents, I was interested and ignorant to a lot of the mentions in the text about various decrees and restrictions and transit camps and concentration camps and the structure of the various police forces, the German and the Dutch and the raids. And so I started reading books about the history of the Holocaust in the Netherlands, of which there aren't really great resources in English. There's a book by this guy named Presser who goes through all the decrees, and that was really helpful. But I felt like I needed the historical context. So I started creating these little, what I called history briefs that connected to the mentions in the text. And then I passed that off to Jenny, and she did additional research, and she drafted these short little engaging stories about each of the pieces of history. And then after Jenny, I worked with Kristen Swan, who was a copy editor. And there was really no other book like this in that it's in so many voices, and some people's voices, English is their third language. And then there's, you know, bits of other languages interspersed, and there's the history and so many dates that, again, it was really a challenging job for Kristen. And she worked really carefully with me to decide, you know, how much do we refine the awkward intonations so that the reader isn't tripping over it, for example. And then we just had to create a lot of our own rules about how to deal with all the different languages, and, you know, and then follow those rules. So she was remarkable to work with. There's 63 images in the book. They're the actual letters and diaries and documents and photographs are in objects like a teddy bear that my aunt had with her the whole time she was in hiding, or a false identity card. They're so beautiful that I really wanted the reader to come as close as possible to what I was able to do, which is to hold these things and experience their beauty. So Chris Gardner is a photographer who photographs art for museums, and I worked with Chris to photograph these objects and re-photograph the photographs all with a little bit of a real shadow, not a Photoshop shadow underneath them, so that when they're printed on the page of the book, it really feels like they're really there. You can almost pick them up. So Chris and I worked together on that. And then Robert Jan van Pelt is a Holocaust historian and a world-renowned expert on Auschwitz. And he was going to write the foreword for the book, but he became very excited and involved. And was a wealth of knowledge. So he also wrote some chapter introductions and then did some editing on the history briefs, because he had in his mind what Jenny and I couldn't necessarily find in English books or websites, and even really reputable sources sometimes had conflicting information and dates on that history. And then, shall I continue with my
please.
Who collaborated?
I mean, it's really like an army of people who made this book up.
It really was, and I'm so, so lucky and so thankful to have had these collaborations. They were, you know, just delightful to work with such experts who were also so passionate about, as equally passionate about the project as I was. I worked on this for over a decade, and while I was working on it, I was continuing to do my job, which is to plan, design, and produce books for art museums. And those projects are always on deadline. And I knew that my project would always be the last at the bottom of the pile. So I decided to create an advisory board that I met with every 2 or 3 months. And that's really served two purposes. One was, in a sense, I then had a client that I had to answer to, so that whatever I had planned to do for those few months, once we had a meeting coming up, I had to, I had to accomplish something. And then they were just a group of people who were really helpful to bounce ideas off of, and on the narrative, on the design, on agents and publishers and et cetera. So that was a group of 6 people who for 2.5 years met with me on the project, another collaboration. And then, yeah, so then there was my husband who, helped in countless ways, supporting me as I traveled and researched, and sometimes took a little time off from my other work and worked late into the night and made meals, etc.
I'm Gary Shapiro. This is From the Bookshelf on KSCO, and we're talking this week with Daphne Geismar. She's a book designer, and her newest book, of which she is the author, is called Invisible Years, A Family's Collected Account of Separation and Survival During the Holocaust in the Netherlands.
It's there are so many frustrating things about COVID-19, but to have put all this work in and then have the book come out right now when it's very difficult for you to get around and publicize it and do a book tour and all that must be very frustrating.
There are a lot of frustrations to it. There are some good things.
I'm dying to hear what you are.
But you know, after, interestingly, after working on this book and having much more of a visceral understanding of what my family members experienced, and knowing that with COVID-19, there are people, I feel very fortunate. I am working and I'm not sick and no one close to me is, and, but people are sick and people are dying. So it's really too bad that the book launch had to be canceled and that it's much more difficult to put a book out right now, but in perspective, it's just not so bad. And the good things are, so I was supposed to have a book launch at the Yale the Yale Fortunoff video, Holocaust Video Archives, they were going to host a launch. And it would have been really wonderful to have a launch in person. My aunt, who's the only living person, who's one of the narrators who lives in Israel, was going to be here, even though she said she'd never travel again, and she's 88, and other family from Israel and the Netherlands and friends and colleagues from all over the country were going to come. So that would have been a really nice celebration. that had to be canceled. But then Robert Jahn and I did a really wonderful book talk that was hosted by the Museum of Jewish Heritage in New York. And 300 people attended from all over the world. And so those are the good things. And that actually, sometimes online, we can meet, we can reach more people than we would in person. And so as much as we curse Zoom and our computers, there's something good too.
So there are 9 family members in your book. Can you give us a little who's who?
Sure. One of the 9 is really an afterword, because he's the only narrator who is from Poland. And in 1939, when the Germans invaded Poland, he and his family left and went to Russia, and his parents died of typhoid, and then he was on his own. He went to an orphanage in India and eventually made his way to Palestine. So his story is completely different and acts as kind of this afterward counterpoint and gives us, you know, a sense of the magnitude of World War II and the Holocaust. All the other 8 narrators were in the Netherlands. And so there's, interestingly, you know, there's the only people who are narrators are people who wrote. And it just really made me think that, you know, if you don't write or make art or leave something behind, your story isn't there to tell. So my paternal grandfather, Erwin Geismar, is one of the narrators. And he's the only one who didn't survive. He was murdered in Auschwitz. And but his wife, my maternal grandmother, is not in the book because she didn't write anything. And then there's my maternal grandparents, who were hidden in the church in Rotterdam. Their 3 daughters, one of which is Miriam, which is my mother. And then my father and my uncle Natan, who is my mother's sister Judith's husband. So it's 3 families. It's the Dzuta family, the Cohen family, and the Geismar family. And it's 3 adults and 5 children. 5 children.
It's really, you know, really puts, I was born like 10 years after World War II. So I grew up with a sense of it. You know, I knew that it had happened, and, you know, I went to Jewish summer camp and I went to temple, and they always told us, you know, never again. And we were always, even when we were really little, we saw Holocaust films and things like that. And I can kind of remember when the word Holocaust was suddenly the one that was being used. I don't know. I don't know officially when that came into being, but so I'm wondering, you know, today a lot of young people probably don't know as much about it. I mean, and they know about it from, you know, it's something that happened a million years ago to them. And it's nice the way this book brings these people to life. They're not faceless numbers. So I wonder, you know, who was your audience? Do you think that this is a good book for young people?
I do. I definitely think it's a good book for high school students, possibly middle school, maybe with some in a selected way. You have these 5 children who were, the book, there's a little bit of before and after the Holocaust, but primarily it's from 1940 to 1945. And so they were 10, 11, 12, 13 years old. So you're hearing from adolescents, and there's girls and boys, and they're poignant and they're adventuresome and they're even humorous sometimes, and they're kind of jokesters sometimes. And so it's really relatable, and they're very human, and they're part of families, and they're part of friends and they go to school and then their lives start to slowly change as their rights are taken away. And all of the narrative, I think this reading these personal stories from these two generations, it's really almost, you know, I intellectually understood that the rights of Jews were taken away, but when you hear it, their voices again and again, you hear from five children what it meant when they could no longer go to public school because they were Jewish. They could no longer play with their neighbor because their neighbor wasn't Jewish and Jews weren't allowed to play with non-Jews.
They had to surrender their radios.
Their radios, their bicycles. My uncle Natan says, I had to give away my bicycle, but that was okay because I got a new pair of roller skates. So in the beginning, you know, it was sort of like, oh, these are minor inconveniences, you know, but then they lose their jobs and their schools and communication with radios and telephones and, you know, until they're really completely restricted from public life. And then their lives are at risk and the parents have to make a decision. One of my greatest hopes is that the book can be used for educational purposes. So I do think it's, I think the story and the language are very appropriate for a high school, older middle school audience.
One of the things I found fascinating is the way the Nazis had grouped together Jews based on how Jewish they were, quarter Jewish, half Jewish, full Jewish. I mean, they were all eventually, you know, they all faced horrors, no matter how much Jew they had in them. But
exactly. But it was,
why did they even bother? Yeah.
Right. And that, I don't know, it almost seems like part of their slow, insidious process, you know, not to do everything at once. That, you know, first it was just full Jews and then three quarter Jews and then half Jews. And then if you were married to a Jew and, you know, the same with there was this, the Jewish council was set up and it was run by these two guys, Asher and Cohen, and the Germans set it up, but they had it run by Jews and they restricted all other Jewish newspapers except for this Jewish weekly that was put up by the Jewish council, and that was their way of actually controlling the Jews, and they gave the Jewish leaders 40,000 exemptions for people who didn't have to be deported. So they say, you know, they thought they were helping by putting these rules in place or by making these choices for 40,000 people who would not have to be deported, but then they took away those exemptions until eventually Asher and Cohen themselves were deported. So it was, I mean, it was kind of a horrible, brilliant plan.
Yeah. I noticed in the book that you, and in our conversation today, you've used the word murdered rather than gassed or put to death or executed or whatever. Murdered is a very specific kind of word. And was that a decision that you made to use that word?
It was a semi-conscious decision the semi-conscious decision was made before a more conscious decision was made as I was writing and editing and needed to put the word on paper. But for me, words like perished or even gassed, they're unintentional, whereas murder is intentional. And this was very intentional.
Yeah. I also was interested to hear, you know, I mean, I knew it intellectually, but I hadn't like thought about the fact that the Netherlands was a colonial power. They had colonies, and that some of the characters in your book were involved in those. They were in Asia, yeah?
Yes. So my maternal grandfather, my mother's father, Chaim, wanted to be a pharmacist, and his father wanted him to be an engineer, and he wouldn't pay for him to go to pharmacy school. So the way he was able to go to school was by having the Dutch military pay for it. And then, you know, just like in this country now, if they pay for your education, you have to agree to a certain amount of service. So at that time, it was called it's Indonesia now, the Dutch East Indies was a Dutch colony. And so after he received his education to be a pharmacist, he had to spend his first 5 years working in the Dutch East Indies. So my mother and her sisters were actually born there. And they returned to the Netherlands in 1938. And then, you know, of course, the Dutch East Indies had its own horrors during World War II. The Dutch, who were still in Indonesia, were put into, they weren't death camps, but they were put into concentration camps by the Japanese. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it kind of gives our listeners a sense, Daphne Geismar, of the scope of your book, because I'm thinking, oh, you know, I don't know enough about the Japanese. One of the things that was interesting in one of the history briefs is the idea that because the Japanese attacked Pearl Harbor in 1941, this came as a surprise to Hitler, but Hitler honored his alliance with Japan by declaring war on the United States, which is probably the reason that the Germans lost the war.
Right. Probably.
Yeah, very interesting. There's so many, the history briefs are just like rabbit holes of fascinating knowledge that I want to
they
know
are
about.
That. It was, and you know, while working on them, I went down a lot of rabbit holes, and making them brief was difficult. But my knowledge of World War II, especially in all its vastness, is sketchy at best, and so there was a lot to learn there.
You're listening to From the Bookshelf on KSCO. I'm Gary Shapiro. My guest this week is Daphne Geismar. Her new book is called Invisible Years, A Family's Collected Account of Separation and Survival During the Holocaust in the Netherlands. And there have been many Holocaust books and films, and maybe you're thinking you don't want to read another one. But this one is so fascinating in its firsthand recounting of the story and in its broad scope of history that I think it's essential reading. And even a good place for someone who's never read about World War II to begin their study. One of the things I learned from Invisible Years was that not all the people who hid Jewish people from their oppressors were good people. There was even some sexual abuse.
Right. So, which I've now come to learn is, you know, sadly not really just in isolated cases. So my aunt Judith had, she was in 43, she was 11, 12. Mm-hmm. And, she was hiding with a very large family, and, she had been abused by the father and two sons and had never told anybody, until my mother had been at a child survivor of the Holocaust meeting, and she said, "You know that not all those who hid Jews were good people." And it came out at this meeting that some people were abusive towards those they were hiding. And at that moment, it was the first time Judith ever told anyone. She said, "That happened to me too," and she only told her two sisters. She never told her husband. And never told her daughters, but as we were working together and as our book first it was just going to be a family book, but then we realized that there was a story that was of value to the greater community. And so once we realized it was going to be published, she said, I think my complete story should be told. And so at that point, she told me about it, and she had it written down. She had written it down, but she had put it in a folder for her daughters to read after her death. So it was quite a process, and it was, I think telling it was remarkable. I sensed this weight lifting off of her. Almost, she passed it on to us to carry for her in a good way. And the person who hit her and did this had been honored as commemorated through Yad Vashem. They have a program called the Department of the Righteous, where Jews who were helped or hidden by non-Jews could request commemoration. And so my grandfather had written 13 letters for different people and family members who hid, he and his wife and three daughters, one of which was this family that had been abusive, because Yudit said, you know, for many reasons she didn't tell her parents, one of which was this family. While they abused her, they also saved her life, and she also didn't want to put the burden of what happened onto her parents. So after all that they suffered, with so many family members being murdered, so he was commemorated and honored at Yad Vashem. And once I learned the story and her daughters learned the story, we requested that his name be removed. And at that time, that was when we learned that this was not uncommon. And that especially as the Holocaust survivors are now so much older and won't, you know, as they realized they wouldn't be here for very long, they decided they needed to tell the full and true stories. And so a number of people did go back to Yad Vashem and request removals of names because of circumstances like this. So there were so many good people who were helping for all the right reasons, but not everybody.
And there was among those Jews who were being sheltered by good people, there was a kind of a Stockholm syndrome that happened. They went to church. They wanted to continue with their church studies and continue to be part of the families that had shielded them.
Yeah, that was very common. And, you know, I think they, you know, especially I think for younger kids, that, you know, it was, you know, parents had to give up their children, not knowing if they would survive or their children would survive. But with very young children who were then raised for 2-3 years by another family from maybe even before they could remember, that was their family, and you know, and part of it might have been going to church. And and I think that, you know, there was a lot of difficulties with family reunions in certain cases after liberation.
Yeah, this one part in your book, I can't remember specifically, but they didn't come running into each other's arms like reunited at last. They just sort of, oh, hi.
Exactly. My mother writes that the happiest day for her was when she had been hiding in the town of Haarlem, which is just like a half an hour west of Amsterdam. And though she had been in that town for 2 years, she had actually never seen the town because she was in this house that she could never leave. And so there was liberation, and the Canadian troops were coming through the town and handing out food, and they could actually go outside. And so she was with her, the woman who hid her, and her adult daughter, and the other three children, Jewish children that weren't related to her that she was hiding with. And they went outside and celebrated. And she said that day was the happiest day of her life. But then when she got together a week or so later with her two sisters and her parents, it was just so bittersweet, because they were children when they had gone into hiding, and they were really like older teenagers and almost adults when they came out. And their parents wouldn't stop crying, and their parents, my grandmother's had two brothers and two sisters and countless aunts and uncles and nieces and nephews who were murdered. My grandfather's mother and sister were murdered. So a happy reunion was very complicated.
Are you thinking, are you done with this project, or would you like to see it made into a film, or something else happen to it?
Their stories are so accessible and gripping, and the combination of the personal stories with the history is such a, for me, such a great way to learn the history. But I would love to see it have a life beyond the book in any way that it might. And so I'm hoping to be involved in working on a curriculum, a companion curriculum, and that it can be used in schools and workshops at museums or community centers. And if someone wants to make a movie, that would be great. I think it lends itself very well to it. And when I tested this interwoven narrative and these multiple voices, and I had this advisory group, I had about an hour's worth of reading, and we got sat together around my dining room table, and we each took on a voice of one of the narrators, and we did a reading like you would read a play. And in fact, I was going to do that with family members reading at the live launch if that had happened, and but that was canceled, but there may be opportunities still. But it was so moving. And at that moment, we knew that was the right structure for the book. And we were all in tears by the end of the reading. And we were also laughing at parts. And it works very well in that context. And whether that's used in an educational way or as a play or a film, that would be terrific, because the reason I kept it in their voices is so that they could continue to tell their stories, because we don't have, for the most part, Holocaust survivors anymore.
Yeah. When you watch the news of late, in the last few years, I guess, while you were working on this, did you ever feel that there is a connection to our current situation? Do you feel, oh, this sounds familiar?
Yes, far too often. Every political situation, every genocide, and certainly the Holocaust is like nothing else. But there are definitely echoes. The experience of how really ordinary people, if you read the chapter from before the Holocaust, they were just ordinary people living their lives. They were turned into this invented enemy, and then persecuted in their own country, and then not welcome in other countries. The British Palestine and the United States closed their doors, even though they knew what was going on with the Jews in Europe. And so they weren't welcome in other countries, and then they were stripped of their rights and murdered. And I think we can all think about that scenario of the invented enemy that is persecuted by others with so many other groups. So that continues to reverberate, and which is why I think it's so important to use, to get to know who these people are as individuals in my family, and to get to know our neighbors and others in our community who aren't necessarily like us, because I think it's getting to know people on a personal level that might make some changes.
I hope so. This book is called Invisible Years, A Family's Collected Account of Separation and Survival During the Holocaust in the Netherlands, and the creator of the book, my guest, Daphne Geismar. Thank you so much for joining us on From the Bookshelf.
Thank you so much for having me. It was really nice to talk to you, and you asked such interesting questions.
That's it for this week's From the Bookshelf. I hope you enjoyed the program and will come back and see us again next week. I'm Gary Shapiro. Thanks for listening.